40 years ago this month, President Richard Nixon officially introduced what he called the War on Drugs. A decade later, Ronald Reagan launched it as a national crusade.
It's time, as Nancy said, for America to just say no to drugs.
Since then, though, the Obama administration has thrown out the term war on drugs, and this past week, the Global Commission on Drug Policy issued a report calling the crusade a failure. But back in the 1970s, the U.S. fight against drugs, especially marijuana, didn't seem like a war at all. In fact, for the gentlemen smugglers bringing bales of pot into Florida and South Carolina, it was a party, complete with a Jimmy Buffett soundtrack. Wasting away. Journalist Jason Ryan has written a new book about those days. It's called Jackpot, High Times, High Seas, and the Sting That Launched the War on Drugs. And he admits, South Carolina isn't really the first state that comes to mind when you think of the international drug trade.
I think most people imagine Miami, New York, L.A., these metropolises, not the South.
But there was a history of this. There is this kind of connection to the smuggling routes and smuggling trades that dates way back, right?
Right. I argued that the smugglers, the pot smugglers, or the gentleman smugglers, followed in the footsteps of a couple people. First, the pirates, Blackbeard the pirate, Stede Bonnet. Then during the Civil War, blockade runners. And then in the 30s during Prohibition, the rum runners also used the South Carolina coast. It has so many waterways and inlets and rivers that go into the ocean, but even the Customs and DEA didn't have boats until the mid-70s to patrol it. So they were doing it by car, which was very inefficient.
So let's talk about these guys. First of all, you call them gentlemen smugglers. Why?
They're atypical drug smugglers. Nowadays, we take for granted that violence accompanies all types of drug trafficking. And certainly in Mexico, there are many, many horrible acts of gruesome violence and murders. But back in the 70s, these smugglers were college educated and they were also averse to violence. They reasoned that if there was plenty of money to go around, and it was as much about the fun as it was the money, so there's no reason to carry a gun.
So for them, this was just a good time and a way to make some quick, easy cash.
Right. It started out a lot of fun. Slowly, I think greed creeped into the picture. But when you think about the places they sailed, they often took sailboats down to Jamaica, to Colombia, South America. So it was nice adventure sailing, tons of pot and liquor on board to get you through the trip, even if it got a little boring. And when you came home, you had a nice landscape and friends waiting for you.
And one of those friends you talk about as part of the backdrop, the community of these folks, especially in Florida, down in the Keys, was Jimmy Buffett. Can you paint us a picture of how he fit into this and what that culture was like down there?
Sure. As Jimmy Buffett was making his name and starting to become a music superstar, his friends included some of the gentlemen marijuana smugglers. Mr. Buffett owned up to tossing a few bales of pot himself in a Rolling Stone article back in the 70s. It's tough to say if Buffett inspired the smugglers or the smugglers inspired Buffett's songs, but I think it was probably a little bit of both.
You end up portraying these gentlemen smugglers almost like folk heroes. I'm thinking especially about Les Reilly. Can you tell me a little bit about this particular smuggler?
Sure. Les Reilly grew up in Columbia and attended the University of South Carolina, but did not finish. Head out for the Keys, and he found a utopia there. He could make a living cutting lawns, but soon he found that instead of going out for a day of shrimping, it was much easier to head down to Jamaica for a few hundred pounds of pot. So he kind of fell into smuggling by accident. And from his perspective, money was important, but quality of life was more important. And I think you would struggle to find a victim associated with his alleged crimes, unless you want to make the argument that any kind of drugs brought into the United States causes moral decay or something like that. But otherwise, there are hardly any victims. He was delivering a product very much in demand.
But it was illegal, and he knew he was breaking the law.
It was illegal, though, in the 70s. In 11 states, having possession of small amounts of marijuana was not a criminal offense. Also, Jimmy Carter had argued to Congress that marijuana should be decriminalized, though they ignored him. And when Reagan came to power a few years later, he changed things and went full force against marijuana, making it public enemy number one.
Reagan launches this new, more robust war on drugs. Henry McMaster becomes the South Carolina U.S. attorney. And he really takes this on as his own mission.
Yes, he was a young politician looking to make a name for himself. And he came up with this idea through a little bit of help from some colleagues to create a task force to target drug smuggling in South Carolina. And they named it Operation Jackpot. They didn't know who was smuggling in South Carolina, but they knew drugs were coming in somehow. And so he basically gave the case to a customs agent and an IRS agent and said, the drugs are coming in, find out who's doing it.
And what happened?
They were scratching their heads when they got their orders, and they're just wondering what they were going to do, how they're going to find these men. Eventually, they struck upon the tactic of visiting local realtors and car dealers and asking, has anyone young made large cash transactions, purchased nice homes, purchased nice cars, paying in cash? And they got a couple names or they got a couple properties. And when they were able to start tracing the paper trail, they saw that they were registered to offshore corporations and that certain local attorneys had facilitated this paperwork and the closings. And then they were able to turn the screws on these attorneys and get more information out of them. And they really started picking up steam. And in 1983, issued the first indictments, which were for 42 people, accusing them of close to $1 billion worth of smuggling.
Did I read that you'd actually interviewed at least one of these guys? Is that right?
I was fortunate to interview many of the kingpins, and that was the best part of the research, was sitting down with them and some other smugglers and some law enforcement agents, too, and just hearing all the war stories of all the close calls at sea, of surviving hurricanes and sinking ships, of paying off partners with gemstones.
In your conversations with these smugglers, now that they're on the other side, having served their prison terms, did they express to you any regrets?
No, but in some ways it's a silly question when I ask if you could do it all over again, would you? Or do you have any regrets? Because there's no changing what happened. There's no getting back that time spent in prison. And I don't think even if the deep down the smugglers felt like they have regrets, I don't think they would own up to them. They're very proud people. And I think that they don't believe they did anything wrong. They're simply out to have a good time and they weren't bothering anyone in their eyes.
Jason Ryan is the author of Jackpot, High Times, High Seas, and The Sting That Launched the War on Drugs. Jason, thanks so much for joining us.
I love being here. Thank you.